We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Wednesday, March 20th. This month has already flown by, and other things are already flying by on Capitol Hill as we are waiting momentarily for Representative Chip Roy to join us. And I'm told he is now ready. And so we are talking about, good morning, Representative Roy. We're talking about, I think this is an omnibus, a minibus, or the short bus. I mean, I'm not really sure where we're at in terms of the funding. So maybe you can let us know what's going on Capitol Hill.
Well, good morning, Jenna. Good to be with you. And yeah, I mean, we're back at it again in the swamp, spending other people's money and racking up $1 trillion of debt every 100 days. And this is where I just fundamentally disagree with my Republican colleagues and the ones that are making the decision to proceed and allow the Democrats to essentially control the shots. We've been passing legislation with way more Democrat votes than Republican votes. This is where I think the Speaker and some of my Republican colleagues should do something different. I think we should lead. I think we should do what the American people sent us here to do, limit spending and fight for the policy victories. We're going to, this week, move a bill that will be the second half of a large omnibus that was just divided into two. If I'm going to give a little credit, it does build on the work we started last year, which was to change the town, pass appropriations bills, get Republican input with amendments. But it leaves most of that on the cutting room floor. And instead, we'll spend more than Nancy Pelosi's spending levels. That's true. It will largely leave non-defense spending flat. That is, leave it at Pelosi's levels. There's a few cuts here and a few increases there. It will continue to fund the World Health Organization for the most part. And again, I don't have the text yet, and we're supposed to vote on it in 2 days. That's another problem. But I think it'll fund the World Health Organization. I think it'll fund the United Nations. It might pull back on UNRWA funding, which is money to Gaza, but we're not sure yet and haven't seen it. It will continue to fund wide open borders. It will not hold the DHS accountable. I think it's going to give them more money for ICE beds and Border Patrol agents, but they'll just use that to keep processing more people because they don't even use ICE enforcement. It will continue transgender surgeries. It will continue abortion tourism. It will continue diversity and equity inclusion at the Department of Defense. It will continue to fund all manners of sins in the Office of Refugee Resettlement at HHS. It will continue to fund, for example, abortion research, that is research and, quote, fetal research, which is being used for the ridiculous things that we've learned about, like the DC-5 and other stuff. All of this is stuff that Republicans should be fighting harder and be willing to use the power of the purse to stop. So I'm going to fight it, and I hope more of my Republicans will oppose it than support it.
Yeah, all of these things that you're describing, Representative Roy, sound really bad and not conservative. And so why is it that this always has to be a package? I mean, I thought that Speaker Johnson, one of the main things that he was an advocate for was doing things kind of issue by issue. But when you have this type of a big omnibus, even if it's split into two, all of this stuff does not sound like it's a good thing to fund. So why can't we do something better than just some minimal increases when we're getting all of this other trash along with it?
Well, if I were going to argue, make the arguments that I think the Speaker is making, and look, he's a friend and he's a good man. I think he would say that he, you know, was dealt a short straw and didn't have enough time to get this all on track. And he's got a razor-thin majority, and it's difficult in divided government. Okay, it's all true that it's difficult, and we have a thin majority. But we had a thin majority last year when we passed H.R. 2. We had a thin majority when we passed Limit Save Grow, which legitimately cut spending. And we had a thin majority when we cut a defense authorization bill that dealt with the abortion tourism and all that stuff. When we passed 7 appropriations bills and had 3 more passed floor to floor. So bottom line is this. there's a disease in this town which says, well, you know, we can't get that done because, Chip, we have divided government. And so you just have to understand. And, you know, we've got to fund government. Shutdowns kill us, all that stuff. By the way, this idea that shutdowns kill us, or that you got to back away from leveraging the power of the purse because you're afraid of a shutdown, isn't backed up by history, right? When we had a fight with Senator Ted Cruz in 2013, a righteous fight that was proper to try to stop Obamacare, we eventually caved. We should have kept fighting so we could try to save us from the abomination that is Obamacare. We won a lot of seats the next year. We did. And everybody said, oh, we'll get killed. No, they want to see people that are willing to fight, right? When President Trump fought in 2019, we actually still did okay in 2020. We didn't, I think we gained a few seats. They always act like it'll be cataclysmic. The American people don't view it that way. And this whole idea that we've got to go win seats and majority makers, you got to do everything you can, make that all more expensive and more difficult and more and less likely to succeed when we just try to do that rather than leading with a vision that will get the American people to rally behind us that, oh, these Republicans are serious and they're fighting for me. Last point I'd make is I think the leadership class, the appropriators, the hawks, they get hung up on, you know, the details of this town rather than a vision that we can rally around. And so, for example, it's like, well, Chip, we can't do this or we won't have money for defense. Well, guys, if we don't change the woke culture at the Pentagon, then more money at the Pentagon isn't going to save our country from assault. We've got to restore who we are as Americans. You got to stand up on that rock and get people to want to stand up and defend this country. You can't just use the Pentagon as an excuse, as they do, to pass all manners of sins.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And I think you're absolutely right that at least the listeners of this program all across the country would agree with you that we want to see people stand up and fight, and conservatives fight for conservative causes and not just cave. And one of the things also that you mentioned was also mentioned by Senator Mike Lee on X yesterday, that he said, I really hope this isn't true, the speculation that Speaker Johnson wants to waive the 72-hour rule, which is one of the last standing protections against the kind of mischief that results from a rushed, highly centralized legislative process. So is this going to move forward as quickly as Friday, or do we maybe as constituents have more time to call our representatives and tell them what we think?
Well, I think we're going to get rolled over and they're going to try to move this bill because the most powerful force in Washington is not fighting for our constituents and freedom, but it's jet fumes so that people can catch their planes on a Friday. There's nowhere I want to be on Saturday more than being home in Texas. It's my little girl's birthday. My son's got a fantasy baseball draft plan, but I don't believe we should waive the 72-hour rule. I think we should, frankly, have a longer rule. I actually fought for 5 days, not three. I think we need plenty of time for these bills to be out there because the American people need to see them and understand what we're doing. And frankly, these folks need to feel the pressure. They need to feel the pressure of moving, a bill that is at odds with what the American people sent us here to do. Jenna, I know you, and I know a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, agree. Of course you have to compromise. Of course I'm not going to get everything I want. If I get the World Health Organization defunded, I may not get cuts to the UN this time, or vice versa. If I get an end to transgender surgery funding at the Pentagon, or an end to some of the diversity, equity, inclusion programs killing cohesion, I may not get an end to abortion tourism. Like, I get all that. You get all that. I don't even have to ask you, and I know that you get all that. If I sat here with our good friend, Governor DeSantis, he would say, I'm not sure how I feel about exceptions on abortion, but you know what? Or, you know, he might tell you how he feels about it. But you know what? I signed the bill because it was a good bill in Florida to have a heartbeat bill. And we thought exceptions were, that's what the bill that got to my desk. And I want to go save life. Then you can go have an academic debate about exceptions. But the point is, you have to figure out how to compromise. But you don't compromise doesn't mean capitulating right out of the dang gate, then jamming us with a 48-hour bill. And then just saying, here you go. Here's $1 trillion, 1,000-page, whatever it is. I don't know how many pages it is, bill. And, figure out what's in it later. And, good luck, America.
Yeah, so well said. And I couldn't agree more. I mean, you have to balance the practical realities with the the long-term goals, and you have to incrementally get there. And the left is so much better at doing that, unfortunately, than the right, which brings me to my next question for you, because you've been an advocate for the TikTok legislation as well. And there are a lot of very concerned conservatives thinking that this is just going to give the left, almost similarly to the Patriot Act, some kind of way to manipulate that legislation to invade the privacy of Americans. Is this more of we're doing what we can now and looking at the practical realities, like you just said, and this is the legislation that we can pass that, you know, Biden has said he'll sign if it gets to his desk. So what would you say to reassure Americans that, you know, this type of legislation isn't going to go down the same road as something like the Patriot Act?
Well, first of all, I have great respect for my colleagues that worked hard to get that bill passed, and I'll talk about that in a second, but also those who opposed it. There are 15 conservatives in the House who opposed it. There are 50 Democrats who opposed it. The 15 Democrats, or Republicans, sorry, 15 who opposed it, most of whom are my friends, right? It kind of divided the Freedom Caucus, I'd say maybe, not quite in half. About a third of them opposed it. And the reason they opposed it, and you articulated it, was that they had concerns about whether or not this might impinge on the First Amendment or somehow empower the government to meddle with the market and go basically Bigfoot these big, some of these tech companies in a way that will infringe on our First Amendment. Well, I just don't believe that's true. You asked the question. It's a 12-page bill, okay? I would applaud this bill if it were Trump in the White House, if it was any Republican in the White House, if we had the majority of the Senate. I think it is a good bill. It's 12 pages. It is limited to four foreign adversaries. They're literally written in there, four foreign adversaries: Russia, China, North Korea, Iran. What we say is that if they're collecting your data, American citizens' data, if that company that is controlled by those foreign adversaries is collecting your data, that data is going back to them, then and only then can we say we're limiting the app's availability in the market. Well, all right, you know, it's 12 pages. If something's not quite right about that, we can tweak it. We can fix it. People say, well, what does control mean? Well, we defined control. I think at some point you got to walk and chew gum. I've had this argument with a few of our friends where there are, you know, like, oh, Chip, but, you know, the real enemy is Google and Meta and what they're trying to do, and they're targeting Trump. Okay, I mean, fine. Let's go figure that out. What are you going to do? Are you going to break them up? Are you going to, because if you break them up, you're just going to have a few smaller companies that are all doing the same woke crap. We've got to find out what we're going to do in dealing with big tech, because this stuff is killing our kids. It is killing our kids. It is killing our country. They are targeting you. If you're listening to this, understand that. They are targeting you. And to have the Chi-Coms targeting you, and they're sending different stuff to their kids, patriotic stuff, and they're showing smart people and scientists, and they send us, and they have us targeting all of our kids, and we've got mental health issues, and they're, you know, girls that are being, like, you know, fat shamed, and then they're on there and they're looking at suicide stuff. They're all, you know, they're pumping all of our stuff purposely to try to undermine our citizenry, and then doing political stuff. And by the way, if you wanted to go search Wuhan virus or China virus in through TikTok, you can't find it. It's a 400-to-1 ratio compared to, like, Instagram, which, by the way, Instagram has its own problems. The point is, you can't give your foreign adversaries power to collect data on your people and then use it against you. That's exactly what we're doing. It'd be the same as if we were doing it in World War II Germany. So I think the bill is a very good step in the right direction to try to stop this absolutely pernicious and deadly targeting of American citizens with technology to kill us without a shot.
Really well said. And our good friend Steve Dace was on yesterday and said, you know, the left is going to try to manipulate everything anyway, and so we might as well put forward good legislation that protects the American people. And I personally tend to agree with that position and everything that you just laid out. But in the last about 30 seconds we have with you, you don't think that this does give a sitting president, whoever that is, too much unilateral authority, or is that checked by the text of just those four foreign adversaries?
I believe that it is checked by the focus on the foreign adversaries. I'm certainly open and willing to, if the Senate thinks they can tighten that down a little bit or define control a little better, great. That's how our system's supposed to work, and let's ping pong it. But don't walk away from it out of hysteria. Let's take the bill, 12 pages. If you want to tweak that and define it more tightly, great. I think it does the job. Some strong conservatives like FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr, he's really good on this stuff. Go look at him if you haven't followed his Twitter thread. He's written a lot about it. It's not a First Amendment problem because it's conduct, not content. It's not a bill of attainder because it's prospective, not retrospective. I think the bill is pretty good. But again, that the process is supposed to work. But the Senate, if they got a better definition of control, like Mike Lee and others, then tweak it and send it back to us and we'll pass it.
Yeah, well said. Well, thank you so much for your consistent and faithful fight for conservative values. You are one of my personally most respected people on Capitol Hill, and I really appreciate you, your stalwart conservatism, and fighting for what's right. So please never, never change that. Always appreciate you dropping by, Representative Chip Roy. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Last year, because of you, Preborn's network of clinics saw over 58,000 babies saved. Thank you to all who made this possible. Let's celebrate these precious babies. Daisy and her husband decided they never wanted kids. When she found out she was pregnant, she immediately thought abortion. But after she and her husband met her baby on an ultrasound and heard the heartbeat, their hearts melted and they chose life. Her baby, Jeffrey, is healthy and beautiful. Daisy and her husband can't even imagine life without him. Each of these babies are truly miraculous, and every day, Preborn celebrates 200 miracles. $28 a month can be the difference between the life and the death of a child. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection that doubles the baby's chance at life. Let's join together and help mothers choose life. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as we continue to talk about the congressional spending bill, the top headline this morning from our friends at allisrael.com is the U.S. to continue the UNRWA funding ban until 2025 under new congressional deal. That, of course, is the U.N. Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, as two probes into UNRWA workers' terror ties are still ongoing. So to talk about all of this and more with the state of Israel is our very dear friend Joel Rosenberg. Good morning.
Hey, Jenna. Great to be with you again. How are you?
You know, it's been a few weeks and we have missed you, but we're still praying for Israel and, you know, really excited to have you back on the program. So it's a good morning. Thanks for dropping by.
Well, I'm grateful to be back on, and I'm now in the States. I'm in Dallas. I've been on a 6-week trip traveling around speaking at National Religious Broadcasters Convention at various churches. I was preaching at Prestonwood Baptist Church here in Dallas the other day, spoke at Dallas Theological Seminary yesterday, briefing people on what's happening in Israel and unfortunately also on the train wreck that's emerging in U.S.-Israel relations, because President Biden is attacking Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, and now Senator Chuck Schumer, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, it basically called for regime change in Israel. Schumer isn't calling for regime change in Iran or Russia or China or North Korea, but Israel, America's most important democratic ally in the Middle East. So it's just an insane moment, and it's a good time to reconnect with you.
Absolutely. And we always appreciate your updates and glad to have you back in the States. And of course, you know, not in some of the terror tunnels and other of those things that I know must have been just a horrific experience, but also at the same time, you know, kind of this bizarre reality that we find ourselves in now in 2024. So what is the tenor over in Israel as we see people like Chuck Schumer, as you rightly pointed out, are calling for regime change in Israel, yet not any regime change for our actual foreign enemies?
Yeah, well, it's an astonishing moment. And it continues to suggest the dangerous direction that the Democratic Party is moving in terms of abandoning Israel. Now, it's not wholesale yet. I mean, obviously, President Biden has stuck with Israel and supplied ammunition and weapon systems. He's providing political cover for Israel at the United Nations Security Council when so many countries are trying to blast us and condemn us. And for those, President Biden deserves credit. But In recent weeks, as you know, President Biden has been cursing Prime Minister Netanyahu. I mean, using just the most foul language we're not going to use on Christian radio. And how do we know that he's doing that, saying these things about Netanyahu? Is because the White House senior officials are leaking those terrible, hateful comments about Netanyahu to the mainstream media. And then Schumer goes out and gives a speech in which he describes four obstacles to peace in the Middle East. Hamas is one of them, and Netanyahu is the other. Now, remember, Netanyahu is the guy who made four Arab-Israeli peace deals that are historic, that Schumer praised, that Biden praised. Those are the Abraham Accords. So to attack the only democratically elected leader and ally of the United States in the Middle East, Prime Minister Netanyahu, in the middle of a war, while we're fighting against a genocidal enemy, it's insane. And I think it's not that the Democratic Party has completely abandoned Israel, but it's not just AOC. It's not just Rashida Tlaib. It's not just Ilhan Omar. It's not just the Squad. That's not a minority segment. It's turning into – they are influencing Biden and Schumer at the top. And who is benefiting from this? Hamas, Iran, right? Because they see daylight. They see that Netanyahu is being isolated from the United States, and this puts more Israelis in danger.
Well, I think, Joel Rosenberg, that describing Biden as insane is probably – the most apt characteristic that we have, because what he says, what he does, a lot of this doesn't make sense. We know that he isn't even all there in terms of what he looks like in his mental capacity. But all of this coming as there were reports that Biden also spoke with Netanyahu about the Rafah invasion by phone on Monday. And that was their first interaction in more than a month. And according to NBC, it's during the call, Biden asked that Netanyahu send to Washington a senior interagency team composed of military, intelligence, and humanitarian officials in the coming days to hear the United States concerns. And Biden confirmed that Netanyahu agreed to that invitation. So is this potentially a good next step?
Well, all right. So that's a great question. Let me answer that. But let me first say, just to be clear, I'm not actually calling the president of the United States insane. I'm saying his approach towards Israel right now is insane. It's not treating an ally as an ally in the middle of a war. And I think it's reprehensible what Biden and Schumer are doing. Now, that being said,
well, I personally would characterize him as insane, but that's just my opinion, so it's okay.
Okay, fair enough. Well, that would be impeachable, and I think he's impeachable on allowing an invasion. Under the 25th Amendment, right, he should be removed if he's insane.
100%.
Under Article 4, he's allowing an invasion of the southern border here in Texas and, of course, across the southern border. And I think that's impeachable. But that being said, this is another problem, a terrible problem with the Biden approach, which is he says he loves Israel, wants Hamas to be defeated. But now he doesn't talk to Netanyahu for a month, curses him instead, and then insists that Netanyahu not allow the Israeli Defense Forces to invade the last stronghold of Hamas in order to allow Israel to finish off the Hamas terror threat. What in the world is the President of the United States doing telling the most faithful ally the United States has not to defeat a terrorist enemy? Did Israel ever tell, an American president, don't defeat ISIS, don't finish them off, show them mercy? What are we talking about here? You can't be pro-Israel and say that you're pro-Israel and curse the Prime Minister of Israel, demand regime change, and tell Israel not to finish the job when it comes to Hamas. I don't buy it.
Yeah, well, and I think it's so presumptuous as well of the United States to tell Israel how to conduct its own defense. And even though it is a strategic ally, of course, and there can be collaboration and assistance, you know, Israel is its own sovereignty and clearly, you know, was invaded, and the October 7th terror attack was reprehensible. And so for it comes across to me as just completely audacious of the United States to then go in and tell Netanyahu that he needs to do something different while also calling for a regime change. It seems like we're almost purposefully, and, you know, by we, unfortunately, Biden is the United States federal head right now. And so, you know, it reflects on Americans. But it seems like he is trying purposefully, and Schumer and the rest, to put Israel in a no-win situation.
Yeah, well, that I think is exactly what's happening. And I don't even think they're doing it for strategic reasons. I think they're doing it to win Michigan, you know, and to placate AOC and Rashida Tlaib and all these anti-Semitic members of the Democratic Party who hate Israel and hate Jewish people. So that you know, all politics is local, right? So ultimately, you ask, why is President Biden and Senate Majority Leader Schumer using such anti-Israel attacks? I believe I trace it to the fact that they're trying to shore up their own weakening position inside the Democratic Party. But what they're doing is that they're appealing to the worst elements inside the Democratic Party. And I don't even think that reflects all of Democrats. Is it a rising movement? Apparently it is. Otherwise, Biden and Schumer wouldn't be doing it. But yes, back to your original point. Look, if the United States military and political class have actionable, good, solid, tactical, and strategic ideas for the Israeli military to do better in winning this war, great. Have a private meeting. Give classified advice. Israel welcomes that. But Israel does not welcome, nor should any pro-Israel American welcome, an American president and a Senate majority leader attacking the democratically elected leader of Israel in the midst of a war for our survival. And that's not to say that there isn't criticism that's merited of Netanyahu, but that's an Israeli internal discussion. Can you imagine a scenario in which Netanyahu or any other Israeli leader decided, you know what, we hate Democrats, we're against all Democrats, and now we're going to publicly support Trump for re-election? There's no way that the Democratic ally, especially a small one like Israel, is going to wade into, or should, into an American presidential year, into an American presidential election. But that's exactly what Biden and Schumer are doing in Israel. And it's just wrong at every possible level.
That's it's such a good point. Joel Rosenberg, my special guest today, who is the editor-in-chief of All Israel News. You can read the top headlines there at allisrael.com. And you are so right that all politics are local. And while the Democrats are trying to claim in every way, you know, election interference and other things, that's exactly what they're going over in Israel and doing, right? Which is completely hypocritical. But as I always say, if Democrats didn't have double standards, they wouldn't have any standards at all. And they also, I mean, it's true, unfortunately, but then also, they are manipulating the situation to try, as you rightly pointed out, to influence the election here. Because one of the things that I absolutely hate about our 24/7 news cycle is that we live in a perpetual election cycle. There is never a time that we just say, okay, the election's done. Now let's go actually do the business of governing and all come together as Americans and actually hash out, you know, some of these things that are obvious policy differences between Democrats and Republicans, the left and the right. But we live in this perpetual, how is this going to influence the next election? And that is not a good way to do policy. But that also begs the question, Joel Rosenberg, why is attacking Israel or wading into their election and calling for regime change there, why should that play better to Democrats in Michigan than going after actual foreign adversaries like Russia or China and Iran and North Korea? I mean, that says a lot about the mindset of Democratic voters.
Yeah, and it speaks to the confusion going on inside Biden himself, Schumer, and the Biden White House and the senior Democratic leadership in Washington. Because if you really want to win with Michigan, you might not want to put the entire automobile industry out of business, right? If you want to help win, if you want to win Michigan, you might want to stop illegal invasion that's now taking over more and more of Michigan and other cities. As people are coming from the southern border, but they're being spread out all over the country. You might want to get inflation under control. You might want to help economic growth. Look, there are reasons. You don't have to attack Israel while Israel is under attack. Like, this just shows the moral bankruptcy of senior Democratic leadership. Literally now at the top. And it's particularly disturbing to me that Chuck Schumer, who's the highest elected Jewish official in the history of the United States, for him to attack Israel, for him to attack the democratically elected leader of Israel in the middle of a war, by the way, at a time when Netanyahu has an emergency unity government, right? It's not like Netanyahu is operating on his own. He's operating with the opposition leader in his own cabinet, working together to win the war. That's about as good as you're going to get in a democracy, right? Biden and Trump aren't working side by side in the White House, fixing America's problems, right? So Schumer doesn't have to like Netanyahu, but Netanyahu is not some rogue agent, trashing our country of Israel and operating on his own as some sort of dictator. He invited the opposition leader into the government 2 or 3 days after the October 7th attacks. And Benny Gantz, the opposition leader, immediately agreed. And this is a sign of the health of Israeli democracy. There will be elections at some appropriate moment. Israelis do want to weigh in and choose leadership going forward. And we'll see if Netanyahu survives. I don't know that he will, but it has nothing to do with Biden and Schumer. They're supposed to stand with an ally. It's basic 101 decency of being an ally is not throw them under the bus while they're fighting radical Islamist terrorists. But the Democratic leadership does not get it. And I guess we shouldn't be surprised, but it's one more evidence of how deeply wrong and morally bankrupt the Democratic leadership has become.
Well, Joel Rosenberg, I'm just glad that when you were talking about Michigan, you didn't use the word bloodbath to describe the automobile industry, because that's really, the main thing that the media should be focused on. None of this other other information that we're talking about. But Joel Rosenberg, always great to have you join. Again, go to allisrael.com and read the latest headlines there. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we need to talk about Peter Navarro. And this is, of course, the former Trump advisor who turned himself into federal prison yesterday after being convicted at trial of contempt of Congress, two counts of not complying with a January 6th subpoena. And I'm going to tell you my opinion from a legal perspective and why we need to think about this in a conservative way and not just a siloed tribalism. And so I'm going to preface this by saying I know that some listeners are going to kind of have that immediate reaction of saying, well, if you're not outraged by this, then you're not outraged by, all of the lawfare and all this. Well, no. I am definitely outraged by all of the political persecution, the weaponization of government, and all of the things that Jim Jordan and his committee are going after. All of that we can talk about, all of the targeting of conservatives in various ways, out in front of abortion clinics and, you know, all of the Catholics and the Christians. I mean, everybody that's been targeted. I get it. I understand. We need to, though, as conservatives, support the rule of law. And I'm going to unpack this because we need to always think through what happened. And we need to think through what is the best response to this, not just supporting someone because either they are conservative, they're MAGA, they were former Trumper, you know, whatever that is, because none of that actually matters to the analysis. And I say this knowing Peter Navarro personally. You know, I got to know him very well during my time working on the Trump campaign. He was in the White House as the trade advisor with all of the stuff that was going on with the China trade deals and, you know, being tough on China, which I fully supported President Trump doing that. I think there were some great executive orders that came out of all of that and great perspectives. So all of that to say, we need to look at this from a rule of law perspective. So my friend Joe Pagliaro, he goes by Joe Pags for that reason, because nobody can pronounce his last name, Joe Talk Show. He tweeted this yesterday. You think we have freedom and liberty? Peter Navarro just walked into prison to serve time for a misdemeanor. His crime? Refusing a subpoena by the illegitimate so-called January 6th committee. Remember, the panel went against the rules of the House. It did not allow for the minority party to choose its representation, as has been found to either delete evidence or hide it. See Molly Hemingway's report. But for some reason, this guy is now behind bars. It's disgusting what they're doing, and half the country is cheering. Sick. Okay, again, this is kind of the knee-jerk outrage. And there's some truth to this, because the January 6th committee did violate the House rules. It didn't allow the then minority party of Republicans to select its members and put people on, including Jim Jordan, who was not allowed to be on the select committee. All of that is true. But this is what I responded and where I want to go with this. The problem is that Navarro simply refused. He didn't challenge his subpoena in court. We can't be the rule of law party and not follow the rule of law. Navarro can't self-determine whether or not he complies with a subpoena or whether or not it is valid. He should have challenged it or sat in the chair. The hypocrisy, therefore, is not that he was held in contempt, but that the Democrats who don't comply with the rule of law aren't. So when you're talking about people like, well, what about Eric Holder? And what about, you know, Lois Lerner? What about all of these other, you know, Democrats and who weren't held in contempt? Well, they should have been. That's actually the response. Not that somebody on our side, and I say our side, you know, broadly, meaning not a Democrat and a conservative, not that he was held in contempt for refusing a subpoena without a valid court justification. We have to, the law should apply the same way to everybody. And so I get the hypocrisy and I get the outrage over the hypocrisy, but the hypocrisy isn't just that nobody should ever be held in contempt or nobody should have to answer to a subpoena and get to self-determine whether or not they think it's valid. I mean, imagine if our system worked this way, where if you get a subpoena and it's, and you think it's weaponization of government or there's some flaw in it, or it's by the opposition party or whatever it is, you can just say, well, I'm going to refuse it. I'm not going to comply. And I'm going to assert on social media or just through a letter back to the congressional committee, just say, well, you know, no, here are the reasons that I decline and forget it. Our system would fail that way. And put another way, how would you feel if the Colorado Secretary of State just claimed that the Supreme Court ballot opinion is illegitimate, says, you know, no, because you know, this violated some law, blah, 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 just like Pags is saying, you know, the House violated its rules, and so it's an illegitimate committee. If the Colorado Secretary of State just claimed that the Supreme Court ballot opinion is illegitimate because she disagrees with it, so just decides to take Trump off the ballot anyway. Well, and of course that would be outrageous because it's not the same thing. There's no actual rationale for that. But go along with my hypothetical here. That would be a serious problem. And so I'm not saying that there isn't a serious problem with Democrats not following the rule of law when it suits them and then turning around and throwing the book at conservatives. But we can't, in our response, selectively cry foul either. And this is where I think that, personally, that Navarro made a big error, because he never challenged his subpoena in court. And part of this, I'm guessing, and I haven't talked to him about this, nor do I want to, but I'm guessing because other people who were subpoenaed by the January 6th committee prior to him did challenge their subpoenas in court on the basis of the January 6th select committee not abiding by the House rules and being basically illegally compromised or violating the House rules, and so having no actual subpoena authority. They challenged the subpoenas based on this, and the court came back and said, well, no, you know, if the House wants to do something about it, they can do that, but the court is not in the business of arbitrating the House conducting itself by its own rules, because the House rules and the rules of Congress, according to the Constitution, the House sets its own rules. And for things like expulsion, for example, the court generally is not going to wade into how the House conducts itself. Similarly, that courts don't wade into my home and my rules. And obviously that's a very different house, quote unquote, that we're contemplating. But the court doesn't redress every single issue that everybody has with various rules. That's what the law calls an issue of justiciability or an issue of redressability. And for a matter to be justiciable under the law, it has to be something that a court actually has jurisdiction over to arbitrate in either equitable justice or full justice or equity at law. And it has to be something that is redressable. And for the House to violate its rules, the House then is the arbiter of that and could provide its own sanctions. So that's why the House, under the Constitution, can set its own rules for its own members. There are some things and some constitutional provisions that are a matter of the U.S. Constitution. And so those are redressable by courts of justice and courts of equity, because those are matters that are substantively premised and textually within the Constitution. And so, for example, you recall Thomas Massie's lawsuit against Nancy Pelosi when she was trying to fine members of Congress, including Massie, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and a few others for not wearing a mask on the House floor. And she had set that as the former speaker as a rule during the COVID pandemic. And Massie didn't want to comply with that. And so Pelosi was trying to take the fine out of the stipend or the actual salary of representatives. And there's a constitutional provision that says that the House cannot change the salary for its members during the tenure of that particular sitting Congress. And so it was a matter of substantive constitutional provision, not just the House dictating its own rules. And these are important points of law. And you may be saying, well, that's a very, you know, that's a very fine point. Well, exactly. I mean, this is why law is complicated and why we need to understand the legal rationale for some of these things instead of just saying, well, Massey's a great guy and I like him, therefore his position must be right. Or Navarro used to work for Trump and I think this is ridiculous that conservatives are going to prison, therefore I'm championing him. That's a political opinion, which, you know, people are entitled to think that. You can voice a political opinion, but it's not a legal justification. And there is a very big difference. And I think as conservatives, we need to genuinely separate what is a political opinion versus a legal justification or a legal theory, or even a legal argument, or a constitutional argument, for example. And this is why I always say in talking about interpretation of the Constitution, a political question is a matter of should. It's a matter of policy. Should we do X policy? Should we enforce X thing? Right? And that's a matter of politics. And we can debate all of those issues. And we do debate all of those issues. Those are actually non-justiciable questions. And there's an entire doctrine that's actually called the political question doctrine in the law, because courts say those policy questions are not up to us. They're up to the political branches, according to the separation of powers in our constitutional framework and how our government operates. Those are political questions, and we don't wade into that. We're not going to tell the government, I don't think that you should have, passed this spending bill, even though, people, maybe some constituents don't like it. We just talked to Representative Chip Roy at the beginning of the program about it. If Congress goes ahead and decides to pass it, you can't sue your member of Congress for voting yes or no because you don't like the policy preference or the politics. And that's part of the whole doctrine of qualified immunity, right? Which is another thing that the Supreme Court is going to contemplate relative to President Trump and executive immunity. These are very important questions. But that's the should. The can someone, an agent of the government, or can someone who was a former advisor to the president in an administration like Navarro, can they do X, right? So that becomes a constitutional question or a legal question. If it's not specifically a constitutional question, it can be a legal question of can, which generally speaking is redressable, is justiciable, because when the Supreme Court looks at can the president, for example, issue this executive order, is that within the scope of his limited powers that are given by Article 2? That is a justiciable question. It's not whether he should or not, that's the policy question. It's does he have the power? Does he have the authority? So what Navarro should have done in terms of the legal is actually challenged this in court and asked a court to determine whether the subpoena was valid or invalid and whether his defenses of executive privilege, which he asserted in his letter to the January 6th committee, were valid legal justifications to not comply with a congressional subpoena. Because subpoenas generally, when issued by a court or by Congress, are presumptively valid. You have to get an arbiter with authority, and in this case it would have been the court, to say, no, the subpoena is invalid, you're released from your obligations under that, whether it's testifying or submitting documents or whatever it is that the subpoena calls for. He failed to do that. So then Congress, by a House vote, held him in contempt. They referred him to the DOJ, who then decided, in my opinion, based on politics, decided to prosecute. But it's not that it wasn't substantively grounded in a breach of the law. It's simply that the DOJ was unwilling to prosecute other political actors like Eric Holder and other Democrats who refused their subpoenas. And why did they? So the answer here is not that Navarro should just skate because he just sits back and says, nah, I don't like this. I think that it's my opinion that the January 6th committee was illegally compromised and it violated the House rules. So, nah, I don't have to comply. If we get to self-determine as individuals whether or not we comply with a subpoena or whether we go along with the rule of law, that's anarchy. That's total chaos, right? So what we need to be asking for in this situation, and what I think the whole Navarro thing evidences, is how the law is selectively applied. That's the problem. The problem is that Democrats aren't prosecuted for the same thing that Navarro did. So why is the DOJ throwing the book at Navarro when it's not against Democrats? That's the problem. But it's not that, this is so terrible that, he's going to prison for 4 months. I mean, he got a trial with full due process. He could have potentially accepted, a plea. He could have simply complied. He could have sat in the chair, exercised his constitutionally protected right to remain silent. I mean, all kinds of different options. He went to trial. He was found guilty. They did not stay his sentence based on an appeal, which he's going to file. That's how the process works. And so in my opinion, it was a terrible, terrible outcome for something that could have been easily prevented by either simply complying and asserting his privilege in the chair, or by going through the court process, which is our rule of law. So we have to think about these things, not just politically, but conservatively, because we are the party and the people that should be advancing and advocating for the rule of law, but equal application to everyone. And if you want to rant about this with me more and you disagree, you can always reach out. Jenna@AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.